Blog Talk Radio.
Of 76, April 30th, last Thursday. King started his career in the late 1950s with the Drifters, singing hits including There Goes My Baby and Save the Last Dance for Me. After going solo, he hit the U.S. top five with Stand By Me in 1961. He returned to the charts in the 1980s. Including a two-week spell at number one in the UK following its use in the film of the same name and a TV advert. King's other hits included Spanish Harlem, Amor, Don't Play, That Song, and Supernatural Thing. The singer died Thursday, April 30th. In 2011, King explained how the Drifters turned down Stand By Me. Fellow musician Gary U.S. Bonds wrote on Facebook that King was one of the sweetest, gentlest, and gifted souls that I've had the privilege of knowing and calling my friend for more than 50 years. He wrote, "I can't tell you that Ben E. will be missed more than words can say. Our sincere condolences go out to Betty and the entire family. Thank you, Ben, for your friendship and the wonderful legacy you leave behind." Actor Jerry O'Connell, who played Vern in the film Stand By Me, alongside River Phoenix and Corey Feldman, tweeted, "You know you are good when John Lennon covers your song." Benny King was a wonderful and immensely talented man. Born Benjamin Earl Nelson, he initially joined a doo-wop group called the Five Crowns, who became, eventually, the Drifters, after that group's manager fired the band's previous members. He co-wrote and sang on the band's single, There Goes My Baby, which reached number two in the U.S. in 1959. Ben E. King had six songs in the U.S. Billboard Top 40, between 1961 and 1975, but the group members were paid just $100 per week by their manager. And after a request for a pay raise, it was turned down. The singer decided to go it alone, and in the process, he adopted the surname King. His first solo hit in 1961 was this song. See if you remember it. He originally intended Stand By Me for the Drifters, but said they turned it down. So he worked on the song when Atlantic Records boss Ahmet Ertegun paired him with writers Gary Bieber and Mike Stoller. In my vocal, I think you can hear something of my earlier times when I'd sing in subway halls or the Echo and perform doo-wop on street corners. The Guardian in 2013, but a lot of influence. I had a lot of influence too. Singers like Sam Cooke, Brooke Benton, and Roy Hamilton. The song's success lay in the way Lieber and Stoller took chances, though borrowing from symphonic scores, and we had a brilliant string arranger. The song went on to chart 9 times on the U.S. Billboard 100. King's version twice and 7 times with covers by artists like John Lennon and Spider Turner. It was also the 4th most played track of the 20th century on U.S. radio and TV. Earlier this year, the U.S. Library of Congress added it to the National Recording Registry, declaring that it was King's incandescent vocal that made it a classic. Stand By Me, Spanish Harlem, and There Goes My Baby were all named on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list of 500 songs that shaped rock and roll, and were all given a Grammy Hall of Fame award. King also set up a charity to help young people continue their education. As the 1960s went on and rock and roll took off, King's commercial success waned. He continued to tour. And in the mid-1970s, Ertegun was so impressed by one of his shows in Miami that he decided to re-sign him to Atlantic Records. That led to a return to the charts with Supernatural Thing, Part 1, which reached U.S. Top 5 in 1975. King returned the spotlight again in the late 1980s when Stand By Me was an theme song for Rob Reiner's film about boyhood friendship and was used in a British TV commercial for Levi's jeans. The star also established the Ben E. King Stand By Me Foundation, a charity that says it helps deserving youths working to further their education and to assist various civic organizations and associations in their efforts to improve the quality of life of their constituents. You know, we choose records back in the day that Ben E. King and so many talented singers like Ben King sang the songs that we remember when we were flying with the Great Eastern Airlines. And so that's why we choose songs that we remember and hopefully our listeners as well. Hello again, folks, and welcome to the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We're glad you're with us tonight. Another great American singer has passed on. The songs identified by Ben E. King were during the great history of our airline as well, Eastern Airlines. Our only purpose is to bring you news of Eastern, both past and present. You may also hear a song or two selected by our producer, yours truly. Enjoyed popularity during the days Eastern 2 was the preferred airline by the traveling public. so much so that it became the largest passenger carrying airline in the free world. The legacy of Eastern is carried forward by people like you by tuning in each week to share these memories. Those regulars on our show each week try to do exactly that, sharing their memories. Well, let's see. Jim Hart, who is our normal host starting out our show, is not with us tonight. Bill Joseph, the backup, I don't think Bill's with us tonight. Bill, did you check in late? Are you with us? No. So therefore, I'm going to do a little bit of their jobs that they normally do so well. It's always great to start our broadcast by listening to songs that meant so much to our generation and by saying hello to our host and guest, finding out what's happening in their part of the country and getting a brief weather update. The weather in my backyard may not be the same as in your backyard. As a matter of fact, it's absolutely gorgeous outside. Now, let's see who shows up tonight. I think we have, starting way up there in Long Island area, we have two of our hosts that check in with us. And let's start out with, I think I see George Jen on the board. George, how are things up in the New York area?
Good evening, everyone. And it was probably the best day of the year so far today. Close to 80 degrees with a nice breeze blowing and crystal clear skies. Back to you, Neil.
Very good. Hey, George, is this tuna fishing time of year?
No, it's just starting out for striped bass. Tuna fishing usually begins right around the first week in August.
Okay. Well, the reason I bring that up is I saw Nat Geo Wild Tuna, and the show is really great. I enjoy watching it on TV every Sunday night, and I guess it's the next series that's coming up now. I didn't know tuna fish, if you caught one fish, it was like a month's paycheck. I think three fish brought in last night on the Sunday's broadcast, brought in $14,000 for three tunas.
Well, those are the giant bluefin.
Yeah.
The restrictions, there's pretty good restrictions on those right now. So most of the tuna that we get up here are either yellowfin or albacore, or for about a three-week period in August into early September, we get what are called big eyes, which are just about as valuable as those giant bluefin.
Wow. Yeah, $20 a pound. Wow. Well, over a little bit further to the, I guess, west of you is Frank Segnor. Frank, you probably don't fish, but what's your activities around Long Island this time of year, and how's the weather there, Frank?
Well, right now, like George said, it was a beautiful day, and the air conditioning went on for the first time yesterday as it warmed up. And, you know, a lot of times you don't place George and I where we're located. George is in the northern part of Nassau County, 516, and
uh-huh.
I'm further out east in 631 in the middle of Suffolk County. Long Island is 110 miles long, and I'm probably about 60 miles from Manhattan, where I live right now. And occasionally I go out with my boys to do a little fishing, but I'm getting a little too old to handle the boat anymore. Go ahead, Neil.
Well, you're not too far from the Hamptons, are you not, Frank?
No, I'm not that far. If you all are familiar with in the airports, ISP, Long Island MacArthur Airport, I'm in the neighborhood of that area.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, let's move on down south a little bit further, and let's go over to, I think I see Steve Thompson. You're in the western part of North Carolina, over in Roaring Gap, North Carolina. How goes it there tonight, Steve?
Oh, it's just a beautiful day, Neil, here in our subdivision is called Old Bow. And we have a golf tournament here today with about 50 high school golfers playing in a tournament here. And so our golf course was very busy. But the temperatures were up in the reached up into the 70s, and it was a beautiful day, just a beautiful day. And John and Lynn Reinhardt right down the street to me from me, and I wonder what kind of a day they had.
Well, let's ask John. John, how's your day been?
Well, we had sunshine also all day long, and it was gorgeous. That tournament actually started yesterday, and we live on the number 8 green here in Old Bow, and it's a par. And one of the young men got a hole in one. It was absolutely phenomenal. It flew in the air right into the hole. It was fantastic.
You actually saw that, or you heard about it?
My neighbor actually saw it, and I was out in the yard but didn't get to see it.
Don't you have to have someone to authenticate the fact that this happened?
They do have. They have rangers that ride with the boys. This is the North Carolina State Golf Tournament, and we're one of the courses that it's being played on.
Well, I know so much about golf. When you do a hole-in-one or get a hole-in-one, is it like pulling the one-armed bandit and all of a sudden you hit the jackpot and all sorts of coins pop up out of the hole?
No, doesn't work that way. This means you're that much closer to winning.
And also, you get lifetime bragging rights, right?
Absolutely.
That's worth all the coins that could come out of Vegas, I guess. Okay,
exactly.
Let's go. Let's see. We're going to go down to our guest interview tonight, and that's Jill Cotton over in Asheville, North Carolina, just south of you. Hello, Jill.
Hi, Neil. I have to ditto everything that they've been talking about, how wonderful the weather has been. It couldn't ask for better weather. Sunshine, nice temperatures. It's like open up the doors and windows, let the sunshine in and the fresh air in. Back to you,
right.
Neil.
Okay. Well, let's hope it stays that way for a few more days and months. My next-door neighbor, he just decided that, heck, I'm going to go to Alaska. And so yesterday he pulled out his RV. Looks very much like John, yours, and Lynn's. It's a Mercedes 30-some-footer, kind of like yours, except it's a little wider. And they are going to Alaska. 3 months they'll be gone to Alaska. I don't know if I could stay 3 months away. I don't know. That's pretty tough. But I guess those guys that like camping, like you, John and Lynn, I'm sure you enjoy it. I enjoyed it when I was young. I don't think I can do it anymore. Yeah, there you go. I slept in tents and underneath wings of airplanes at Sun and Fun, which I attended a week or so ago. A lot of fun there. Let's move across North Carolina over into South Carolina. Gay, are you in Hilton Head?
It's pretty today. Just enjoying the cooler weather before our stifling summer heat gets here. But it was just a great day today.
Good. I kind of cut you off there. And any classic? I think you've already had your big golf tournament there at Hilton Head.
Yes. Yeah. The week after the Masters is when it comes here.
Right. And then next week, or actually this week, we're having ours since I'm up next up at bat. Yeah. Well, we'll come back and get Jim Graybill in a minute. But over here in Jacksonville, Florida, the TPC is about to start Thursday, the Players Championship. I don't know what to call it. It's TPC, I think it is. And it's over at Ponte Vedra's Sawgrass, and a beautiful course there. So this week, yeah, Tournament Players Championship, I think. Is that right? Golfers? Is
sounds
that right?
About right.
Chuck?
It sounds about right.
Did we lose our host here?
I don't know.
I'm here.
Sounds like
I'm waiting on my turn.
Why don't you go right ahead, Howard? Or is that Chuck?
It's Chuck.
Chuck, why don't you go ahead? How are things out there in your neck of the woods?
It is just like you guys. It's been absolutely beautiful today. Actually, we had a high of 80, and it looks like it's going to go down into the 60s tonight. The weather was absolutely gorgeous out on our 53 golf courses that we had here. Our tournament's coming up pretty soon. I think the Arnold Palmer people are going to be coming into town here in another month or so. So we'll have, I don't know if it's a championship tournament, but I think he's going to show up here. And I think that we're going to have a really nice summer here. It's going to probably be a little hot. So back to you.
Okay, we missed a little bit of that because our show was interrupted by not here, but in our network that provides us this service. They temporarily lost connection, and we're reconnected. So I take it then, Chuck, that everything is okay in Village City, USA, home of 51 or 53, or how many golf courses you could have there.
We have 53, and we're going to have two more, and that'll be the end of them.
Okay.
I just finished my dissertation. You were off the air for a minute.
Yeah, I was. Okay.
I have a question for you, Chuck. How many acres?
Go ahead.
How many acres do 53 golf courses take up?
The village's total takes up 25,000 acres.
Wow.
And we have 25,000 acres.
How many square miles is that, do you know?
No, not well, out of fan. I know from one end to the other end, it's 10 miles, and it's about 8 to 10 miles, well, almost 12 miles wide, so you have to figure it out from there.
Wow.
I know a golf cart, my golf cart, goes 80 miles on one charge, so I can go from one end of the villages to the other and not run out of a charge, but mine's a little bit bigger than some of the other ones. But you can just about get to any place in the village with a decent golf cart.
Well, speaking of golf carts, not only does the villages probably hold a record number of golf courses, but it probably has more golf carts than any place on earth.
We have 35,000 golf carts.
Okay. All right.
Wow.
Glad you had that answer.
Wow. Sunday,
our newspaper. The only reason I noticed that you get a little newspaper and it tells you.
Wow.
Do you have on Sunday the golf cart drag races?
No, but one guy did take a golf cart over to the Daytona and dragged it over there somewhere. He put two motorcycle engines in it.
I have, since Cecile Intriago is not going to be with us tonight. Cecile, are you by any chance on the air? I know we were talking a little bit earlier, and I forgot your reason for not being here tonight, but we'll tell you. I'll tell you a little bit later on about our communications with Eastern Airlines. And Cecile has been the coordinator of our contact with the company, and we have some late news. We'll tell you a little bit later on in the show. Well, let's see. I think that's got everyone. If I've missed anyone or if any of our listeners, I've opened every microphone up. And so be as quiet as you can, folks. Unless you want to talk, then your voice is what we want to hear. And
they also got mute buttons.
Yeah. Yeah, they can mute us out or the sounds in the background. Don't mute us out, but the sounds in the background at any rate. And so you want to say something, just come right on. And this is your show, not our show, because we enjoy doing a show about Eastern Airlines, and that's what we want to talk about. Let's do some housekeeping before we get to our program. If you've listened to our past shows, you know that we can be reached online during our live broadcast, and there are a couple of numbers that you can call. Talk to us. Just call area code 213-816-1611. That's area code 213-816-1611. And from what I'm told, it's very hard to get in on the toll-free. We only have one toll-free line. It's all we can afford. And so folks call us in, call in to us, rather I say, should say, at 877-572-1861. That's 877-572-1861. So call either of those numbers, and you'll be able to put right in. And if you do call and want to ask us a question, make sure you press number one on your phone. And that will alert me here as the producer of the show to see your desire to come right in and join us in our conversation. And you can also reach us as far as tuning in. We're not your typical tune-in station where you roll the dial left to right, FM or AM, because we are cyber. And we have you tune us in at a www address, and that's at EALradioshow.com, www.EALradioshow.com. And when you get to that page, just click on the arrow in the circle on the radio icon, and that will put you into our radio show if you tune us in at 7 p.m. Or it may put you into one of our archived, because we have 215 archived radio shows that you can listen to. Or you can go to our sponsor, the Retired Eastern Pilots Association's website, and click the radio icon that you see on their homepage. That's the EAL, the www.REPA, REPAonline.com. RepoOnline.com, and you can listen to us there. And either one of these locations should put you right into our radio show. Well, let's start our show up tonight. And I did have the pleasure of uncrating a beautiful engine. Took me a long time to pull all the nails and take all the wood away from this beautiful engine that has four banks of cylinders, each bank containing seven cylinders, and that's 14 spark plugs, folks, per bank, times four. So we have 28 cylinders on this R4360 engine built by Pratt and Whitney.
Neil?
Yeah.
This is Steve, and I have a question about Chuck. Did he finish the... his school on this Pratt & Whitney 4360 engine, and did he help you?
I just told him how to take the crate off.
Yeah. If it had anything
did you
to
not
do
tune it up for him?
Yeah. Let's see what this engine, since I tuned it up, let's see what it sounds like. Here we go. We're starting a 3,500 horsepower engine, folks. That's bigger horsepower than any reciprocating engine Eastern had in any of its aircraft. So here's what it sounds like. Well, it doesn't sound like that, but here, let me see if I can do it again.
Who did the work on that?
Not me.
That's kind of typical at 43-6, isn't it?
Well, I want to go back to my old standard, which is the R2800. It always starts up. And so, folks, clear prop, and I'll tell you a little bit about the story of the 43-60 in a minute. Clear. Well, I didn't tune it up as well as I should, but when I discovered that on the internet, it caused all of my problems for the rest of the day. I started this morning trying to get the 4360 out of the cart, and when I did, I tried to download it, and Lord, did I have problems for the rest of the day, because I had 100 and some odd viruses set in on my computer.
So goodness.
Just about about an hour ago, my computer geek finally wound up cleaning out my computer. So.
I remember now.
We got a lot of people remembering a lot of things. Okay, so that's our introduction to our show tonight. And as you remember, the TV show host, Ralph Edwards. Do any of our listeners remember Ralph Edwards? Back in the late 40s, are you that old? And
yeah.
Into the early 60s, proclaiming in its opening introduction, "This is your life, Jill Cotton." Because that was the show that introduced so many celebrities to a wonderful half-hour show, and Roy Rogers, Lou Costello, there were so many celebrity entertainers and politicians and so forth that were on that show. So we're going to do a little bit of that each week and listen to This Is Your Life, Jill Cotton, because we want to hear from our host about what got them to Eastern Airlines and what they remember about it. Jill Cotton, hello.
Wow. Who would have believed it? Me on This Is Your Life, and I can't say better late than never, because I never figured never was always going to be there. Well,
let's start with... Let me ask you a question. Let's start off with where you were born, and not when you were born, but where you were born, and I'm sure our other hosts have a host of additional questions. So, Jill, let's start from that point, and we'll learn a little bit about Jill Cotton. Where were you born, Jill?
Well, I'm a Florida girl, but I was actually born in Greenville, Pennsylvania, and my parents lived there for a short period of time right before I was born, but my memories come from Fort Walton Beach, Florida, where I grew up mostly, and I say mostly in the best sense of the word, because you have to understand that my dad was a tech rep on aircraft engines for the Allison Division of General Motors in conjunction with the Air Force. So when you start up engines, I wish my dad were here to hear them. Because he would love it. He could tell you what the problem was and what you needed to fix.
Okay,
Jill. This is Steve. How did you yeah. end up in the where the heavens kiss the peaks in Asheville?
When my parents retired from when my dad retired from General Motors, we lived, of course, in Fort Walton. And he decided he wanted to go to the most ecologically clean area that he could figure out in the continental United States. And he ended up in Franklin, North Carolina. And, of course, when during the years coming up here, I bought property. My husband and I moved up here. We both transferred to Atlanta base. And after my husband died and I, being alone, my daughter, who's living in Black Mountain, said, "You're moving to Asheville." And so that was my last move. I ain't going nowhere no more.
Well, I hope that you drive down to my sister Lynn Reinhardt and I, where we grew up in Bat Cave.
I will, but we all got to get together and do that.
Yes.
sounds like a plan. Well,
Jill, this is Chuck.
Chuck, go ahead.
I got a question for you. When did you first discover you wanted to be a stewardess or flight attendant?
Okay, that's another good question. Just around the 1st of August in 1958, my mom, sister, and I flew to LHR, which is London Heathrow, to meet my dad, who was stationed at Scunthorpe Airport. We flew from Idlewild, which is IDL, which changed into JFK, on TWA. I was 9 years old at that time and was fascinated by the stewardess on the airplane. I knew then and there that that's what I wanted to do when I grew up. It was like, oh, this is fantastic. I love being on planes. It just made sense.
Jill, when and where and by whom were you hired and when with Eastern?
Okay. Well, just going to move 10 years to the future in 1968, so I was still a young pup at that point in time. I had my interviews with Eastern in Atlanta at the Scott Hutchison building. The first interview was so filled with so many people that I wasn't sure if I would even be asked to come back for a second interview. I was told that if I made it through the interviews, I would receive a letter within a few days. And so I had to wait. 3 days later, I received the congratulatory letter and told to take it to the ticket counter in Pensacola, Florida. And they would give me a ticket to fly to Atlanta for the interview and fly back. And it was like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? At this time, I didn't know the interview was so crazy the first time, I really didn't know who I was talking to. I just did what I had to do. But on the second interview, Jim Vance, who at the time I didn't know was a Miami in-flight supervisor, interviewed me. He told me after our interview I would be receiving information in the mail regarding my class date and information that would be required of me to learn prior to class time.
Another question, anyone? Well, I have one. Was there anything that stood out in that initial interview, Jill, that you remember today?
As I said before, the initial interview was so busy and so many people waiting for the interview. I was 19 years old, basically just 19 years old, and overwhelmed by the number of people that had shown up for just a simple ad in the newspaper, which was the Atlanta Constitution, that it was just overwhelming. I mean, even though my life had been traveling around, visiting things and doing whatnot with my family, I had never been exposed to such a large group of people on my own. But on this second interview, obviously I went through it fine. I knew that I was to expect a letter. The fun part about it was that I had to wait hours, 8 hours, before I could get back on another flight back to Pensacola. So I waited around the airport all day. I went all through the airport. And, of course, that was back in the days when there was no security, too.
Yeah.
Jill.
John.
What routes did you fly, and what equipment did you fly?
I flew everything from the Electra 188, all through all the equipment up to, I mean, I flew the DC-10, I flew the Boeing 747, the Electra 1011. I flew all of them in that time frame from 1968 until 1988.
What routes did you fly?
Oh, everywhere. When I first started, I was basically flying domestic. Once I got a little bit of seniority on me, I mean, the first 6 to 7 months I was on reserve, but that also included a change of base. And it was easier to get a line of flying in Miami than it was in New York at that point in time. So I transferred to Miami, and I flew a 2-day trip with not even one day off between Miami, Canton, Akron, and Cleveland, Ohio for months just to stay off of reserve.
You know, Jill, listening to your early days as a flight attendant, did you guys, you flight attendants, do what we cheap airline pilots did? When we were hired, most of us were 8 to a 2-bedroom apartment. But did you guys share your facilities? I know that you probably were trained. Can you tell us a little bit about where you received your training, and a little bit about, you know, your flight attendants, the flight attendants there? Did you pile up with even after you graduated from the flight attendants training course? Did you share rooms like we pilots did? I remember up in Washington when I was first hired, there were 6 of us, and we had a 3-bedroom apartment up in D.C. But did you do things like that?
We most certainly did. Training was a whole different ball game, but once we got out of training, we were given 3 days to find ourselves. And these are only flight attendants that you were to begin with. 3 days to find a place to live and report to duty on the 3rd day.
Wow.
And it was our flight left, and I don't know the number of it now, but it was like 5 or 6 o'clock at night, and got into Manhattan at 9 o'clock at night. They had a hotel booked for us that we had to pay for, and then they gave us the 3 days to find a place to live and report for duty.
Did you ever fly the shuttle, Jill?
I did. And course, I was trained in New York on the L-188, the Electra, but I decided that I did not want to go for the Tawny, only because I knew I'd be stuck on the shuttle all the time, and I wanted to see what else was out there, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, how long
Jill,
was go ahead.
Yes.
Jill, this is Chuck again. Can you think of an incident or an occasion on one of your flights that kind of stands out in your mind even today?
Oh, there are so many.
That's why most
flight
attendants write books.
You always think of certain things that come to mind, but this happened in the very beginning of me flying. I was still on reserve, on probation in New York. And, you know, when they called, you went. And when I say they called, that was crew scheduling, of course. And on one trip, I was on one of the first flights out of New York after a snowstorm out of Kennedy, and landed in San Juan, and they cleaned up the airplane, loaded up, and when I say loaded up, the catering was full. The whole plane was full because it was over a holiday weekend, and we were trying to get these people back to New York. And before the flight ever took off, we knew we'd never make it back. And when I say make it back, we knew that we would never get back into Kennedy with the conditions that it was in. But we would get close. But then a little lady came up to me and mentioned there was a guy in a seat, which she identified to me, and he had an overcoat on, and he had a shotgun underneath his coat.
Oh.
And I could see that the man was not behaving properly. I mean, not like a normal, you know, in San Juan, even in March and April, it's hot down there. You don't dress in a raincoat.
Yeah.
And wasn't able quite to see, but I said, I need to tell somebody this guy is on board. And I walked up to the senior flight attendant, and she was so busy boarding passengers, I went straight to the captain and told him what I knew. And it wasn't very long after that, and I mean within minutes, that the San Juan police or the airport police were on board removing him from the airplane. And at that time, that's when the gun was exposed.
Mm.
And people started calling police brutality just to my right behind me. And I mean, I can see their faces even to this day that, you know, saying, police brutality, police brutality. And I said, do you want to go to Cuba? And with that remark, they didn't say another word. And it wasn't until another time that we had another flight from Miami with a stop in Orlando that a caterer had brought on a friend and said he was nervous about flying, and he sat in the last row seat on a 727 and didn't know what was going on. We landed in Orlando. Everybody got on, not a problem. And then we taxied out, and the captain came on. I did my announcement. Captain came on, and it said we were having mechanical problems, that we were returning back to the gate, but we weren't going to have, you know, we were going to use the aft air stairs to deplane any passengers that wanted to get off for a few minutes, whatever. And the gals in the back lowered the air stairs, opened up the door, and, of course, he was in the last row of seats. He just was out the door and gone, and the FBI were down there grabbing him.
Yeah.
And that,
you know,
that
Jill, so many flight attendants. Can you imagine all the flight attendants and all of the stories like the ones that you just told us repeated over and over again? How many interesting stories there are out there from the flight attendants that work with the passengers, with all of the airlines. It's just too many. Yeah.
Too many. I keep up with a variety of flight attendants that are still flying for other airlines that I've never met. And yet they express the same things that I went through even today. And it's just a lot harder with all the regulations since 9/11 and the deregulation. And in ways, I'm thankful that I haven't had to go through all that, but I still miss my job.
Yeah, we all do that, of course. And your bases that you were domiciled were, and what was your favorite?
I started at Kennedy, which it included at that point in time LaGuardia and Newark. So you basically had to live in Manhattan because the earliest flight out of Newark was 5-something, so you always had to go over to Newark and spend the night so that you could make the flight, because the first bus out of the West Side Terminal would not leave before the flight. And so it was a tough domicile. Once the new terminal in Newark was built, it became much easier because they had Newark flight attendants and they had JFK LaGuardia flight attendants. But my favorite base was Miami. I loved the flights. I loved the routes that came out of Miami. And so my final base was Atlanta.
And you were fortunate enough, you flew over to Heathrow, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
DC-10.
Yes. I wish I could have done it longer. I would have stayed based in Miami longer, but my home was then in North Carolina, and that was on top of flying all night and having to commute to Miami and try out of Atlanta made it rather difficult.
You know, you mentioned in the past that you had a trip with, or several trips, with Captain Bob Loft.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about Bob and your flights with him? And Loft was, of course, a lot of us know that he was in 401.
Right. He was a dear, dear person. It kind of brings tears to my eyes because we had a very good professional history together. My very second trip after training on the 1011, I flew senior. My first trip, I flew galley, and I had another gal with me, and so we worked together. But as a senior flight attendant, the responsibilities all came to you. And so it was difficult to say, okay, this is what I've got to do. This is a giant airplane. Even though that I had worked a 747, I had never worked in a senior position. And I had only known that I was flying senior when I checked in. So I had no notification so that I could review what I needed to be doing. I mean, 1 hour, I've got 1 hour to get myself up to speed and get everybody in line and know what I'm going to be doing. And it was a New York trip. And boarding was at the L3 door, and people were coming on and getting people organized. And it got down to, it was slowing, the boarding was slowing down. We were getting ready to shut the door, and I was muttering to myself, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm doing it very well. And blah, blah, had such a reputation on the airplane within a month of being very critical of about how everybody does everything and how precise and professional we needed to be. Of course, I reported back to him any kind of problem or discrepancy in catering so that we were on top of all situations. And it was the first flight was really tough, but it came off smooth. And, of course, then we went back to Miami and everything was fine. And we flew trips together that we both knew he had my back and I had his. He knew that if I had a problem in the cabin area, he knew that I'd come to him, let him know what the problem was and what kind of solution it needed. And it was like, it was a fantastic professional relationship. And I'll never forget the conversation that he had the last night that I flew with him, which was the night before 401, and our conversation out to the parking lot at Miami. And at that time, I didn't know I was pregnant. But he told me, Jill, you're too good for this job. You need to stay at home and raise a family. And that's the kind of working relationship we had. I mean, we were honest with each other, and it still brings tears to my eyes when I heard what happened.
I can imagine so. And that was Bob Loft, the captain of Flight 401. They crashed in the Everglades.
Great guy.
Golly, interesting experiences that you had, Jill. And finally, the last thing that we'll ask you tonight, I'll ask, is that for those listening in tonight, what advice would you give any considering a career as a flight attendant?
Be prepared to go with the flow on many situations. Treat your job in a professional level. To me, that's almost the most important part, because professional, you are on your job and you have got to command these people in case of an emergency, and professionalism is the best thing going. You've got to be able to go with the flow and yet maintain that integrity. And I see even today, talking to people that are still with other airlines, you know, you maintain a dignity and professionalism. You can have a good time, but you still maintain those goals.
Yeah. Wow.
Neil. Yeah.
Yes, Steve.
This is Steve. Do we have any late breaking news about the Pioneer's flight?
Okay. I'm glad you asked that question. First of all, Jill, thank you so much for your information that you passed on to us about flight attendants. And we have another host that we're going to talk about, perhaps on the Delta side. I'd like to find out how Delta does it with Gay Harvey. Anyway, so we'll be talking with her a little bit later. But, yeah, we've got some late-breaking news, and we want to get this to you before the end of the show. When I say late-breaking, we've been talking with Ed Weigel, president of the New Eastern Airlines, and they have been very busy the last couple of weeks or a few weeks with the proving runs, and they've done proving runs to San Juan and other cities with the FAA, and they're getting along fine. DOT certificate has been approved, and the FAA, I guess when they cut the strings and you're off by yourself, you've completed everything the FAA has put you through, all the hoops you've brilliantly jumped through with the fire blazing, and that's one of the most difficult parts of the airline startup operation, is to getting through all of the things the FAA can put you through on the proving runs that that an airline must show satisfactory marks to operate an airline. So they're going through that, and as a matter of fact, Ed Weigel, I think, finished up a proving run today. He was on that flight, and we've been communicating with him. We hope to talk with him this afternoon, but it was not possible because he got in a little bit late. So we're anticipating to hear about all of that in a telephone conversation with him tomorrow. And they are very much in favor of and approving the flight that we intend to take from Miami to San Juan. He's very much in favor of doing that, and just as soon as they get their certificate and able to do that. And so we're kind of right now looking at a date of the second Friday starting in June, the second Friday of June, as our startup. We've received checks from friends like John and Lynn Reinhart. Thank you so much, John and Lynn, for sending us a quick response, and with a check along with that, that you want to be on that first flight, whether we call it first flight or Eastern Pioneer flight or whatever we call it, because I think everyone knows now that the very first flight they will operate is going to be the honor flight of all of the World War II veterans, flying them up to Washington, D.C., which they do every year. Some of the airlines, I think most of the airlines participate in that, and Eastern is doing as one of the very first things that they do, getting their certificate, and it's good to be commended for thinking of our veterans of World War II and honoring them and taking them on that flight. And so we hope to be a flight right after that. And their flight, I think, is at the end of this month, May 30th, and they'll be doing that flight. And hopefully around June 14th, we'll be taking our flight. I think it's the first or the second Friday, Saturday, and coming back Sunday flight from Miami to San Juan. So that's what we're looking for Ed Weigel to confirm tomorrow in our telephone conversation with him. And we're excited about the New Eastern. And I intend to tell him again that the fan club that Eastern Airlines has is all of those that are still living that ever worked for Eastern Airlines. We're going to be the ambassadors to promote the New Eastern Airlines. And we wish them well. We wish them success, because they've got quite big shoes to fill in the old airlines, and we hope that they fill them well. Any other comments from our host or callers? We can take them now.
Neil?
Yes, Jill.
It's been a great evening as far as I'm concerned, and thank you for letting me be your first to a long line of other good conversations about our jobs and how we got there.
Well, we're glad that we started our This Is Your Life, Jill Cotton, tonight, the first, and we'll have many more to come. We hope to be hearing much more about the new Eastern Airlines and maybe interview those new people, the brand new folks with the new Eastern Airlines just starting up. Hopefully we'll have some of those in the future. But this is what I hear right now.
Sounds like our saying goodbye music.
That's it. Steve?
Well, folks, there's that music again, and where does the time go? Well, that's our show for tonight, folks. We'll be back with you next week, same time and same station. www.ealradioshow.com. And like one of our popular Eastern commercials, we have to earn our wings every day. We hope we are doing so here at the EAL Radio Show. Now, next week, we hope you'll once again fly Eastern Radio as we bring you more Eastern news, history, and talk with former Eastern employees and friends of Eastern. Now, be sure to tune in and call in at 7 p.m. when flight 216 departs. The gate for the new departure to be on board for the voice of radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Well, from all of the gang here at our radio and remote locations, we all say all together, good night, Eastern family. See you next week.
Good night, Eastern.
Special angel here to watch. I feel your touch, your warm embrace, and I'm in heaven again. You are my special angel through eternity. I'll have my special angel here to watch over me, here to watch over me.
That song was by Bobby Vanton.
Spanish Harlem.
code 416. Are you still with us? Good night.